Richard, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. I mean, I'm sure it's opened the eyes of certainly me, and I hope probably many people in this room. So many questions flow from it, and we do have a bit of time, 20 minutes before we need to break. So do, if you have got a question, do jot it down. We're going to be coming to the floor very shortly. There'll be microphones coming around for those. But because I'm sitting up here and I've got the microphone and I'm in control, I can ask the questions I want before anybody else, which is a real luxury. I'm just struck by the politics of what you're saying. Inequality, if you like, is the fault of the rich. Poverty, the counter-argument is the fault of the poor. And if the problem is inequality rather than poverty, then that changes the politics or the solutions. And I was interested in when we're, but the counter-argument, the one that I want to put to you, is, if you like, the government argument. If we take welfare reform, that the real driving reason for reforming welfare is not to save money, although that clearly is something they're interested in, but it's in order that people take responsibility for their own lives, that you give them control, that you make the decision so they don't become dependent. That is the argument. And I was wondering what you thought of that, because if we follow your argument, and it's about economic democracy and perhaps taxation, that doesn't put any responsibility on the people at the bottom, the poor, whereas the government's proposal is that actually they should be the ones who should be in some way liberated to take responsibility for their lives. Just put your observations on that.
I think that two things. One is that there's a failure to understand the consequences, for instance, for depression and use of drugs and alcohol, of being at the bottom of the social ladder, feeling that you've fallen out of the system, your life is a failure, you can't see any way on. And I've known kids who are perfectly, you know, brought up in good families who couldn't get round to getting the social security and housing benefit they needed. They were unemployed, they were sometimes managing to make job applications, but mainly completely incapacitated by depression. And that idea, you know, we had some talk about it, I suppose, a year ago, that people are going to work and they see their neighbors' curtains are still drawn, they're on social security, they're just lazy, they get up in the middle of the day and so on. That's what you do if you are depressed. And have got, there's nothing going on in your life to get out of bed for. And so I think that we really need to understand the direction of causality around those things. But I think and I do think there's a problem, a small problem of misuse of benefits, not nearly as large a problem as tax avoidance further up. But if you feel in your work that you are just used and exploited, work becomes much less attractive, and you take sickies whenever you can, when you think you can get away with it. One of the great advantages of employee-owned companies and cooperatives is it transforms the relationships between people working together. And one of the people, Oakeshott, who studied cooperatives, says that an employee buyout transforms a company from being a piece of property owned by shareholders into a community. And when you can get some sense of self-worth from your relationships with your colleagues, from a feeling that what you're doing is valued by them, that if you take a day off, you're letting them down, that transforms your relationships with work. And I think we not only need to, the Tories' idea of making living on benefits harder and more difficult, we must actually think about how to make the experience of work a nicer experience.
Thinking about this audience here, the argument about a lot of a lot of poor people, but homeless people in particular, is the old Victorian argument of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the arguments that's often made is that really poverty is the consequence of bad life choices. And if only these people had taken the right steps, I suppose I'm returning to my original point about the responsibility of the individual, that the people who are struggling themselves have a responsibility. That appears to be where the politics of our current government is, whereas you're arguing that it is the responsibility actually of those people who have power to create a more equal society.
My co-author, Kate Pickett, now my wife, did a
These
study...
These things happen, yeah.
Yes, there's nothing like having a joint project, actually. It means you can talk about statistics at 3 o'clock in the morning. But she did a study of women smoking in pregnancy, looking at the ones who smoked all the way through pregnancy despite advice, looking at ones who gave up and ones who never smoked. They looked at all sorts of background factors. And you saw behind these apparently fairly simple decisions, whether or not to smoke during pregnancy, was a vast sort of psychological history. That people who smoked during pregnancy were much more likely to have had rows, to have left home, to have been expelled from school, to have had multiple sexual partners, to admit to having lied to parents repeatedly. A great range of things like that you saw going on, which leads to differences in behavior, which people think, oh, well, you know, people can just decide to behave differently. And there are now so many studies in health where people have been given huge amounts of advice, encouragement. One of them, actually, I'm thinking of, was of trying to get women to stop smoking during pregnancy, where they were visited at homes, at their home by health visitors half a dozen times in pregnancy. Another, taking men identified at high risk of heart disease and counseling them again over long periods, 6 years counseling to eat more healthily, to take exercise, to give up smoking. Abysmal results in those kinds of studies, because those behaviors are actually reflecting something much other, much deeper differences in people and in their backgrounds. And so increasingly in public health, we talk about the early interventions in early life, in childhood, which seem to repay themselves vastly in terms of all sorts of outcomes, whether you look at people's education or incomes later on, their experience of employment, whether they got involved with crime or not. Huge benefits of early life interventions and support. Interestingly, the family nurse partnership, which seemed to make such a difference, using health visitors in a more concentrated way, made such a difference to pregnancy outcomes in the United States. Tried here, it seems to have no effect, partly because here we do have a bit of support through health visitors and antenatal classes, where the poor in the States had almost nothing. But basically, you know, we have so little compared to other countries. I have a slide of what every Finnish mother gets, a great basket of baby care stuff, cot and blankets and nappies and bottles and so on. And, you know, an idea that the state is, it helps people, that we all have an interest in everyone thriving. And, you know, that goes, and we just feel people only have themselves to blame, and it's not my problem, it's theirs. I just get on with my life as community life breaks down and status competition takes over. Mm.
Leslie, I know you had a question for Richard yourself.
I was just interested in the extent to which gender plays across what you're doing. I mean, it struck me some of the things you were talking about, particularly in terms of things like narcissism, self-enhancement, power from the, you know, power, being powerful. I couldn't quite, I was just interested whether anything that, whether you could reflect on that at all. Because, I mean, in terms of homelessness, one of the interesting things about kind of gender is that an awful lot, the received wisdom is that homeless people, particularly rough sleepers, are male. I mean, a lot of evidence is that actually we seriously undercount women who are not, who are homeless. They may not be rough sleeping, but they are actually homeless in some way or another. The solutions are to homelessness often, I think, ignore that. And I'm just interested how that layers across to your research, if it does.
We do look at gender a little bit, perhaps not as much as we should, but you can see the effects of inequality on both sexes. In some outcomes, they're stronger amongst women, and in some, they're stronger amongst men. And obviously, there's and it looks to me as if there's a sort of sex-differentiated response to high levels of deprivation. Men are more likely to be violent, and women become pregnant. You get high rates of teenage pregnancy and high rates of violence, both extraordinarily closely correlated with deprivation. I remember actually a commissioner of Metropolitan Police saying that the map of deprivation and the map of, I think it was, he said, crime in general, were almost indistinguishable. In terms of inequality, the position of women in relation to men, their pay disadvantage or how many women there are in senior positions, their political participation, how many representatives are women, all those things show more disadvantage for women in societies where income differences are greater. I think the causes of death which are most closely related to inequality are the male risk-taking behaviors, and violence, drugs, accidents of different kinds, from motorcycles onwards. But when I talk about understanding dominance hierarchies in monkeys, subordinate monkeys show higher risk-taking behavior. And I think you get that same pattern amongst human beings. And you push men back into that traditional masculine role with inequality, where eventually women have to be chaperoned and protected from the dangers of other men. And of course you see that in some less developed societies where there's great inequality.
I'm going to throw this open to the floor now. I thought what we'd do is, because I'm sure there'll be lots of questions, is we'll sort of take a little group of questions and then we'll consider those. So who's going to start us off? There are microphones which we need for our people in Galway. They need to hear you. So who's going to start us off with a question? Gentleman at the front here. Could you just give your name?
I'm Andy Mabara from Chester. I wonder if you have any comment, Richard, on government position that the argument that people are in this situation, such as homelessness, because they are not taking responsibility for their own lives. If we beat them up by taking away housing benefits, we will stimulate them to take the responsibility. Because it seems to me that argument is not supported by what you've just described, that there has been an increase in homelessness since this raft of policies that have been issued. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, we're going to take a couple of things, if I may, Richard, and then we'll come back. There's a gentleman at the back.
Gerry O'Shea, I'm a GP in Manchester. Just interested in what Richard said earlier about healthcare, and as a GP, and following a kind
of... Can you speak louder, please?
Following, you know, the concept of proportional universalism and I think in Denmark, where they try to target health promotion towards vulnerable groups. Are you suggesting that because in the UK, certainly, that there's more entrenched problems, that that approach is ineffective?
So, yes, your argument is that we're less able to focus in this country. Is that your...
Well, I mean, we've tried to, I guess, when we deal with homeless people or other vulnerable groups, look at that proportional universalism, that approach where we try to target more resources at people with greatest needs to, you know, to reverse the inverse care law, as it were. Richard had said earlier that maybe some of the work, I think he was quoting, had been ineffective, that even though you targeted very long-term projects towards people, if correct me if I'm wrong, that you'd said that that hadn't made a difference, that the problems were so deep-seated that you had to target younger people or pregnant women to see any benefit.
Okay, all right. We'll take another question. Gentleman in the middle of the room there, in the blue. Well, you've got it. Okay. I was going with my line, but anyway.
Sorry. Hello, yeah, my name's Eddie Lewis. I was going to ask you, universal credit's going to be kicking in soon, and I wondered what you thought of the effect that would have on the situation with homeless people, basically.
Okay. And maybe take one more question in this group. Lady just on that table too. Thank you.
Hi, the title of this session, my name is Nikki Evans from Cardiff, so the Welsh representatives here today. It's entitled Health Gap and Causes, but for me, I work for the Health Board, and what I see is a big sort of gap between public health and between operational health services, and there is that real tension between prevention and actual operational delivery. So I was just wondering what your view was about how can we influence people who are managers of services who are sort of facing the cuts, etc., when really the sort of people that we're talking about today tend to fit into the Cinderella services that are inadequately resourced, mental health services, substance misuse services, homelessness services. And so it is really about how do we at an operational level challenge that real gap in our own health service between public health and operational delivery.
Thank you, Nikki. Thank you to all our four questions. It seems to me, Richard, that they divide into two, these questions. One is about, approach taken particularly with the homeless population in terms of taking responsibility or not being able to take responsibility for their own actions, the discussion mm-hmm. we were having earlier, to what extent universal credit might play into that. Obviously the welfare reform is very much driven in the government's mind by encouraging people to take responsibility. So there's that, and then in a moment perhaps we can come on to the idea of actually how we should target resources, the best way to use the services in order to relieve the problems particularly of homeless people. So let's talk first of all about just the argument that actually what we should be doing is encouraging people through universal credit and other ways to take responsibility for their lives.
I think it won't actually make very much difference. The transition will be extremely awkward for quite a large number of people. I'm not actually very knowledgeable about these areas of social policy. I spent all my time trying to understand the social and psychological and biological effects of dominance hierarchies. I think the emphasis all the time on responsibility is a misunderstanding of the psychosocial effects of being lower down in the hierarchy and our worries about how we're seen and judged, which actually affect many people quite a long way up the social hierarchy. Incidentally, some colleagues at the Harvard School of Public Health talked about inequality as a general social pollutant because its effects are not just confined to the poor. Even fairly well-off people do worse in more unequal societies. So I suspect that attempts to take to get people to take responsibility is a misunderstanding and will fail. If you make conditions harsher, life will just get on top of those people even more. They need different kinds of help and resources.
So on the second point about how we should use what resources we have, how, to what extent should we target them? To what extent is a kind of universalism a better approach?
Benefits in Britain are more redistributive than in many countries because they are targeted, but that actually means they're harder to defend politically. You can defend benefits like child benefit that everyone gets more easily than benefits that go just to the poor. And so people in the Scandinavian countries, even middle-class people, feel they get some benefit from the welfare system, whereas in Britain I think they don't. In the United States they certainly don't, because the vast bulk of expenditure doesn't go into things that really change the quality of people's lives. Prevention and putting more money and resources into prevention, I think that public services in any of the sort of fields that I'm dealing with, whether it's mental illness or healthcare or prisons or educational, special education for people with educational difficulties, all those sort of issues, services just pick up the pieces. And they do it in a very inadequate way. We need the services because communities are falling to bits. There are endless problems, but we will be paying for expensive services indefinitely unless we deal with the inequality which is constantly recreating these problems. And again, in the health field, one of the big studies I mentioned earlier, they said when, on the rare occasions when they did manage to persuade someone to give up smoking, they knew that other kids were starting to smoke in the same time. The same is true of drugs, the same is true of alcohol or violence or any of these other problems. You pick up the pieces, but the services themselves are not effective enough to be the main determinant of rates of these problems in different societies. So you create the problems endlessly through the inequality, the big status differences, and you struggle to pay for services that are remarkably ineffective often. And, you know, even with medical care, where you might think you'd find the relationships most clearly between provision and outcome, it's hard to find in the rich developed countries any correlation between health measures and health expenditure per head of population, doctors per head, hospital beds per head. You just don't see the relationships. That doesn't mean medicine is ineffective.
I was going to ask.
It means that its effects are outweighed by the social determinants of health. More important than what treatment you get for your life-threatening illness is whether you get it to begin with and what age you get it. So in the Whitehall study of civil servants, not looking at all at the poor, they're all employed in that study of, well, first study, 17,000 civil servants working in London offices, the second of 10,000, following them up over time. All people who would nearly all regard themselves as middle class, there were threefold differences in death rates between senior and junior staff in the same circumstances. And that was the first study at a time when almost everyone was using the same medical care.
Richard, you've given us so much to think on. Thank you very much indeed. Richard Wilkinson, ladies and gentlemen. Well, it's been an absolutely fantastic morning, I hope you agree. Time now, you'll be glad to know, for a break. A chance to stretch your legs, to network, to have a look at the exhibition. Don't forget the Find and Treat mobile unit parked outside. A chance to eat biscuits, ladies and gentlemen. At 12 o'clock, you go into your parallel sessions, and then after lunch, we'll be back in here for a session entitled What Works at 2 o'clock. We'll see you then. Thank you very much indeed.